What's the date?
16.
16 March. 16 March, A.D. 15. Sandy Hill Special Briefing Course. Well, didn't bring my notes. Because I got to get another gag, that man. Nobody laughs at it anymore. This has been a mad sprint. This is a mad sprint. Back in 1950, people used to yammer at me. Of course, I knew how to administer and administration in general. They used to yammer at me, why don't you do something about the organization? Yap, 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 yap. You know, ARC break, ARC break. Why don't you just drop everything you're doing and go in there and push a desk? Very important. You push a desk. And all of this added up to a big bunch of nonsense. In the first place, I got caught absolutely flat-footed in 1950, completely flat-footed. Wrote a book. Published on March the 9th, anniversary of it has just gone by. Dianetics, Modern Science, Mental Health. I was even contracting at the time to go on and do some stories and novels and so forth. And I had for a number of years paid for all research and so forth out of my own money or my products, the products of writing. And there I was, minding my own business. And the book hit. Nobody ever expected this book to be a bestseller. And it went instantly and immediately to the top of the bestseller list, and it just stayed there and stayed there and stayed there and stayed there. I had a lousy publisher. He was caught flat-footed, too. He was an ex-commie. He's still alive over in New York. He tries occasionally to put out a timid paw in my direction, and when I don't instantly answer up, he ARC breaks like crazy. Finally, HCOSecNY was able to get in touch with him the other day. And it's all good roads and good weather now. But it actually blew him off of his post. It blew him out of his own publishing firm. Because nobody expected it. And his publishing firm was rigged to publish books and make a little money. And all of a sudden it found itself with too much money to do with. And there were just these thousands and tens of thousands of dollars rolling in the front door of that place. And they had one of the biggest book publishers in the country. And yet they still couldn't turn out enough books. Everybody was short of books, short of books, short of books, short of books. And it was just too much confusion. Whatever the political allegiances and other things that the people concerned and so forth, it was just too much. Nobody's braced for this at all. Next thing I knew, right after the book was published and so forth, a bunch of chaps came down to see me and told me they'd fixed up a foundation for me and all was going to be well and they would run all this. That was, in essence, what it was. That moment, I took my finger off my number and I said, all right. It's all right with me. And oddly enough, at those very first meetings, some actions were proposed by me, which we just now are getting the completed cycle of action on, and for lack of which, everything has been appetite over tin cup. But I had one vote amongst eight or nine, or I've forgotten how many it was, and it was just by dint of personality I tried to hold the thing together. You never heard so much squirreling and mess up and so forth in your life. And I didn't have any management control, nothing. As a matter of fact, at that time, you may find it hard to credit, perhaps, but I was totally anonymous as far as anything but the author of the book was concerned. I had a number of U.S. senators interested in this. As a matter of fact, I had the Senate dining room one day. I had lots of friends down there in those days. Still would have if I went down and stuck my nose in. Every time I do, they all say, hey, Ron, where the hell have you been, you know? What's the matter? Are you mad at me or something like that? I said, well, I've been busy. I had the Stennett dining room down there one noon, I remember, along about this period. And you could have heard a toothpick fall from one end of it to the other. I was simply telling people about a group of scientists had found, you see, your effort to leave it anonymous and that sort of thing is well born. Occasionally, why you don't want to use the word or something like this, or you're being timid. And yet I was telling them somebody had found the dynamic principle of existence. I was telling people what it was and so forth. And that place was jammed from one corner to the other with senators and so forth. Next thing you know, the table outside of the perimeter, the table I was sitting at with three or four old senators, and the table outside that went silent, and the table outside that went silent, the table outside that went silent, and the next thing you know, there wasn't anything happening in that dining room. The waiters were standing there, see? Darndest thing you ever wanted to see, you know? And I said, gee, I said, I got a bear by the tail here, you know? That was actually before anything much had occurred. They had never heard of this book or anything. But I said, well, I just write the stuff up, you know? And actually, that was my attitude until about July of 1915. Well, I just wrote it, and I wasn't making any commotion. I wasn't promoting my writing name. Actually, a writer seldom promotes his own writing name anyhow. Names, of course, to me are very, very indifferent things. After all, I'm very well known under about six pen names, you see, so names don't mean much to me. As the guy that was important, but this name, this one name, started to move up and hit me in the face, don't you see? I've worn it very pleasantly and so forth since. It isn't that L. Ron Hubbard is a pen name, it happens to be my own name. But this name was strictly exclamation points, you see, around the place. And I was trying not to wear that hat. And finally, the fellow who was serving a general manager at that time, I was having to do fantastic things. I was putting the place together with my bare hands. Everybody else was running around being important. I'm working stiff myself. I wouldn't quite know what it is to be a sedentary type desk flyer, you know. Just flying a desk as an executive, you see, sitting there at 0 mph, going madly down the carpet, you know. I wouldn't quite know what that was. And I was all over the place, and I think I was delivering 8 hours of lecture a day, or something of that sort. I was teaching about three or four courses. I was buying all the furniture, putting everything together. I'd had to go out and find the building myself because I found out the reason they couldn't find the building is they went around and told everybody with a poor mouth, we're just a charity organization. We can't pay very much. I kept saying, gee, man, we're expanding. We got to get out of here, you know. Oh, I've been trying everywhere. And so I said, Parker, you come along with me. I said, I'm certain that there are buildings in this city. That was what he was telling people. We're just a charity organization. We can't pay very much. We don't have very much money. Money, my God, the doors were falling in with money. And I just cut him off and just scolded him right in front of the building owner of the building we were standing in, you know. What do you mean telling people lies like that? You've got to conquer that hard habit of yours, Parker, telling people lies like that. Turned around the fellow and said, we got plenty of money. I said, give me the keys to the place. How much did you say it was? Oh, yes. Well, give me the keys to the place because we're moving in this afternoon. And the fellow says, well, a lease and so on. I said, that's your lookout. I took the keys out of his hand and we were into our original headquarters. And there were three mainline railroad trains which went one on each corner of the building in a triangle. And that's why you see to this day the Dianetic symbol in our shield. You can just imagine. Well, anyway, I remember I had been sweating it out, working away. tearing around, giving the lectures, and also ran the HGC to the degree that any time an auditor had any difficulty with a case, they brought the case into my office, and I banged him down in the conscience, got the case started, and handed him back to the auditor, and roll him. I used to crack cases, pangity, 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 you see, and then run off and give another lecture and so forth, and gave a night course, and the original HAS course mock-up, which you have now, is the original Elizabeth mock-up. PE came much later. And that was simply that for a certain fee, a number of people could take a rather long, elementary, indefinite course, but they were definitely taught exact data. And they were taught exact data out of book one, Dynamics, Modern Science, Mental Health. They were just taught this book. It wasn't somebody lecturing about how nice life was. They were just told this data, you see. And n-grams and locks and that sort of thing were described to them and so forth. And those people all moved over 100% onto the original HCA course. Well, it was fantastic. I'd give this about 3 nights a week and so forth. It's what you'd see now as the equivalent of the HAS course. See, it wasn't an academy course. It wasn't a PE. These students were given full student responsibility, don't you think? They weren't given very much auditing, but they were given some, and so on. Now, the first real blow along this sort of thing came when I got a hold of the Elizabeth auditors, and I called them together in a staff meeting. We used to have lots of staff meetings, and it was a query on my part. What do you want to call yourselves? It's all right with me, call yourself anything. What do you want to call yourselves? And they said, well, so and so, and they'd get a lot of suggestions. They didn't discuss it there. They were going to have a meeting so that they could decide on this, you see. And they had to get the Los Angeles auditors a little bit later. This was not decided for some time, by the way. And they got the Los Angeles auditors to have a staff meeting, decide what they were going to call themselves, don't you see? And they came back with Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. And I said, Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. All right. Well, okay, I could see myself walking into something here, you see. It's all right with me. You boys want to call yourselves that, all right. And Los Angeles, flicker-flack back and forth on the telegraphs and so forth. And they, Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. That was passed. I didn't have anything to do with it. Oddly enough, many years later, we tried to drop this name, and it was very peculiar, but all of a sudden, we had a completely empty school, nobody wanted the other certificate, and there were no students of any kind, and eventually, when the certificate was reoffered again in Scientology, I think it was Hubbard Scientology Auditor and so forth, we instantly had a full academy. So these boys had a good instinct on this, and they knew what they were doing, but they didn't want to be known as anything else. Now, the point is that I, at that time, was trying to, well, I, after all, had a body to run, and this back in 1950, and I had a body to run, and it was a bad show, because I wasn't getting any sleep, and I wasn't getting very much to eat, and that sort of thing. And I had a very amusing story goes in connection with this, because just before the 9th of March, I had been run into a chap by the name of Palmer over at the Explorers Club who had just had to drop an expedition. It was an expedition to the Duodecanese, some islands which are just south of Greece, to dig up a ship which lies in 30 fathoms of water down there, which is full of statuary from Greece, and it's a Roman ship of Roman times, and there might be something in there by some boy like Praxiteles or something like that, don't you see? So he had run into me at the club, and, oh, hi, Iran. I haven't got much time to talk to you. Do you want an expedition? I said, do I want an expedition? What's the matter with you? He said, well, you know that thing I've been talking about, going over to the Duodecanese and so forth, well, that's all off the Ecuadorian government. The Ecuadorian government has got an exploration that they want me to conduct down there. And as a matter of fact, I got to go right now. And, oh, by the way, here's all the packet materials and all the appointments and the visas and everything that goes along with this and so forth. And it's all yours, Ron. Well, oddly enough, interestingly enough, it was really an even swap, because right at the middle of the beginning of World War II, why the Ecuadorian government had, in connection with the Explorers Club up there, had gotten in touch with a fellow by the name of James Robert Gresham. And Jimmy Gresham couldn't think of anybody to take to Ecuador but me. The Ecuadorian government offered him 50,000 square miles of Ecuador if he could go in and find out who was in that territory. And we were going to go down there, but I unfortunately had a commission in the Navy and there was war on. Anyway, this all sounds very involved, but here the thing came back to me again. Palmer walks into the Explorers Club. He's all excited. He's going down to Ecuador. They're still looking for somebody to go in and get his head lost. So there's the packet, he says. There's the packet. It was just before the publication of the first book. I said, this is pretty interesting. Go on down there and do some deep sea diving. Only 30 fathoms. Well, what do you know? Nice, worn, duodecanese, and so on. So I started writing around to people and connected them as the heir apparent to this expedition and started to whip it up. But there was money available and there was everything else. Those lines are still hanging there, not quite connected. But actually, if you could imagine it, I was thinking, still in the middle of 1950, of occasionally nibbling around about this expedition. Yeah, it sounded awful good. And the deeper we got into 1950, the better it looked. And one day the general manager, after a big board meeting and so forth, got in touch with me. And he says, Ron, he says, you've got to front up here. You've got to front up for these people. He says, they're depending on you and so forth. Well, I wasn't doing anything, not running up. I was just working like mad and wasn't paying much attention to the figurehead on something. I was still telling people this sort of thing. And he said, you must do that. And I, well, that goes your any liberty or freedom of motion you have, don't you see, on something like this. And I shook my head. And in the interim, between the time seeing it was just about 2 hours apart, these times are, I found out that Joe Winter was using the fact of my attributing the development of the subject to a nebulous group of non-existent scientists to squirrel the whole cockeyed lot. And we had some kind of a wild cross going. Mind you, this was a working subject. This was not an unworking subject at all. And we had cases snapping out of it, and we had people coming in and going out shouting three cheers and that sort of thing. It was just good straight Dianetics. It wasn't very soon there. I'm starting to get difficulties with cases, starting to run into cases which were being audited in some peculiar way. I was getting somebody there who was telling people that auditing is an art. There's nothing scientific about it. You can imagine somebody telling you. You can imagine somebody telling students that. A wide open invitation to walk around and do gestalt therapy while they eat candy or something and not do anything for anybody. Well, that was the state that mental health was in at the time of the emergence of Dianetics. Nobody had anything done for him. It was everybody had some kind of weird opinion. I remember they had something running called psychodrama in those days, and it sure is. But these subjects were all pretense subjects, don't you see? You listen to them, they read awful good in the books, but I have the last textbook that was published by psychology, which was uninfluenced by Dianetics. And I took it off the line with my own little pink hand down at the American Book Bindery, because it came off the line. It was the basic textbook of psychology for the University of Chicago. And it rolled off the line, and the last copy of that binding went off the line as the first copy of Dianetics came on. So I just turned around to the girl who was in charge, and I said, do you mind? And picked up the copy. It was right off the binder rollers. I said, do you mind if I take this book? No, go ahead. She was, after all, making her fortune off me, so perfectly all right. And I have that book to this day. Actually, it was insufficiently dried, so its cover is warped. But so is its contents. And I picked up that book. I picked up that book for evidence. For evidence, because I knew that the book following, just behind it, was never going to afterwards have a straight picture of what psychology was. I knew that. And it's got, man's IQ cannot be changed. He's an unchanging animal. We don't know anything about what the psyche is, and therefore we can't give you a proper definition for a psyche. You see, it's got all that stuff in it, don't you see? Well, I didn't want this. I didn't want Dianetics being influenced to that degree. And it occurred to me then and there that there was some truth in what the general manager of the Elizabeth Foundation was saying to me. And I was still a bit queasy about this, though. It seemed to me like, you know, saying, all right, positively and completely, owning up to the truth of it is, I wrote it all, I did it all, it's been in the works since 1938, don't you see? That was a brave statement. So he backed me up against the wall about 2 hours after the first meeting, and he says, well, he says, have you decided? He says, because this is probably going to be a very crucial point. And I said, yes, I've decided. All right, you can tell him I did it all. And I talked from that viewpoint thereon, which is, of course, the truthful viewpoint. Well, I was very reluctant that I took over this type of hat and responsibility, because I knew that all hell was going to break loose, and boy, did it. There was some gal who had left me forever, for instance, down in Savannah, Georgia, the year before, and somewhere toward the beginning of that of the year just previously, hearing things were in the wind, she had turned up and I couldn't get rid of her. I'd have anything to do with her. I wasn't anything, you see. Naval officers being naval officers, they accumulate baggage. My life was not prepared to be a wide-open book. I had been a writer all my life. I had lived in Greenwich Village and so forth. As a matter of fact, my life was sufficiently incredible that I seldom wrote stories about it because they were too unbelievable. And I used to actually have to lie about my life because I was accustomed to boys of my own age or young people or writers of my own age and so forth sitting there, you know, and just calling me a bloody liar. I'd tell them the truth, you see. Well, it didn't pay. It didn't pay. So what you did is water it all down, don't you see? The truth of the matter was, pretty exclamatory sort of point existence. My adventures did not take place in my own textbooks, in my own, that is to say, my own fiction stories. They took place in the raw, and this sort of thing is very easy to catch up with. If you're preparing for the seminary and so forth, why, don't live the life of a pirate. Going to go before a committee of evidence, make sure you have a clean nose for a number of years, or at least since the last amnesty. Well, nobody issued me any amnesties. This girl, she was hammering and pounding around the place and so forth, and there were psychologists all over the place. The commies decided they were going to take us out of the running. And at that time, a definition of a psychotic person was one who thought the communists were after him. They had carefully planted this in the mores of the society, which is a very interesting definition. I don't know, we may do the same thing someday. It's very successful. When we want to get somebody, why, we just spread it around, you see. The definition of a psychotic is somebody who thinks the Scientologists are after him, you know. And then we promptly go after him. I'm afraid we wouldn't do anything that bald. We don't have to. But when things were really blowing up, it was quite interesting that when I approached the Justice Department concerning the state of our organizations and so forth and gave them a list, 200 and some names, and asked them to please tell me which of these people were known as subversive agents. They countered. Edgar Hoover's boy there countered, and he said, no, he said, I'll give you back the names who are not communists, and therefore I myself won't be hung with the fact of having given any state information to anybody. People like to weave the idea that I'm in bad here or there, or people think badly of me, and that sort of thing. That is definitely not the case. If I were in Washington in 1955, if I'd cared to work at it, I probably could have wangled legislation protecting Scientology. It's quite the reverse picture, don't you think? These guys, I go in to see them. Today, I'd go in Washington to see the guys that, oh, yes, gosh, how are you? And the letters I receive on my business lines and that sort of thing. Oh, thank you. Thank you for writing us, don't you say? Very courteous. So on. The atmosphere which has been built up in some people's minds, you see, is there something not quite nice or there's something not quite right about being a Scientologist. You know, well, that's just an operation. That's nonsense. Right at the top, I hear nothing but the snap of the right index finger touching the cap brim wherever I go. It's very interesting. The situation is very good where we are. But in those days, it was equally good. And the FBI was very nice about this, and out of 200 and some names, they turned me back 30. My press relations man, during that period of time, was not just a communist. He was actually wanted by the FBI, and they actually put their hands on him and put him away a very short time afterwards. Revenge was taken against these people that we're never told about. Actually, the FBI rounded the worst of them up. Some of them fled to Mexico. Some of them did this. But these were people who were really kicking our heads in. They were robbing offices. Oh, very incredible. There were a couple murders. This is a wild and lurid time I'm talking about. Well, of course, everybody says, well, you couldn't, you know, everybody says, they must have had something very wrong and so forth. Yes, there was something very wrong. The most forward philosophy of the world that's making the most progress is communism. And it met its match. And it recognized that it had met its match. Democracy as a philosophy had gone completely flat and stale. There wasn't any religious backwash, you see, against any expansion. They didn't have any opponent anywhere in the line. And they were under orders at that particular time to infiltrate all social and domestic groups, don't you see, to do this, that, and the other thing, and subvert things. They had everything running their own way. It was all fine. All of a sudden, somebody stands up and he says, there's another philosophy in the world. And they went to work on that fast. Now you think, all right, after this length of time, it's very hard to believe it. But I was the guy who was hearing the bullets go snap past his ear. Murder, sudden death. Reads like James Bond and Tamer Pages. I rescued a woman who had been electric shocked half to death and was so drugged she couldn't even open up her eyes. They had tried to get her to swear out a warrant to get me committed. An airplane was ticking over at an airport. This is incredible stuff. Airplane was ticking over at an airport to pick me up and fly me to St. Louis, put me in a spin bin where I would never be heard of again. Interesting. The two boys who were sent to pick me up and so forth, unfortunately, had not been as well trained in the science of combat as myself. That's right. I speak once in a while of pistol whipping. Well, there's where the pistol whipping occurred. I wasn't pistol whipped. I said, this is just too confounded thick. I don't know who my friends are. I don't know who my enemies are. I don't know anything about anything. All I know is I want to get the book I'm writing on finished. So I just withdrew from the whole scene. I know I've left you with a definite impression that there were a lot of things going on that you have not been informed of, but I can assure you that there were a lot of things going on that I was never fully informed of. All I know is that I had taken over my hat rightly, and the second I stood into the run wearing my own hat, hard and heavy, that is to say, I'm me, all hell broke loose, and I was trying to hold the fort. It's taken the better part of 15 years to where a foothold could be put in to a point where that hat can be worn in this society. Because it's a hat, of course, that speaks about freedom. It speaks about the betterment of man. It speaks about this sort of thing that you don't have to be a slave. It assaults the very foundations, you see, of your economic systems. It assaults the very guts of the foundation we live in. This is another philosophy, entirely different philosophy. A philosophy that people can't be lied to. You can see through the magic spells, don't you see? The black magic spells being woven. This is a civilization where some N Theta kid sitting in a government chair telling everybody how bad it all is over there and so forth can all of a sudden get 30 million people killed, as one fellow named Hitler did. This is an interesting civilization, and that's because people don't know who they are or what they are, where they're going or what they're doing. All right, you start laying the truth on the line. And it's liable to blow off a bit of confusion. All you got to do is put in a stable datum, and the confusion starts to blow up. In the early days of Dianetics, this is the early beginnings of Scientology, of course, it was the same exact moment, didn't violate that rule a bit. And you hear a lot about things going on this way and things going on that way. What happened then? And wasn't it all terrible and so forth? No, we got through just because of one thing. As I finally, in July of that year, in spite of the turbulence and everything, listened to people's pleas along this line, and I wore my hat of being me, and nobody has ever been able to throw me off of that line since. There have been a lot of tries, and it's very, very, very turbulent. But being able to stand up and say you're yourself, and you did it, and yes, I'm the fellow who wrote the book, yes, I'm the fellow who dreamed it up, yes, I'm the fellow who leads this group, and don't qualify any way, shape, or form. Don't go backing up and saying, well, as a matter of fact, I am God's anointed child on earth. God, you see, God appeared to me in a dream, and all of his lightning bolts, you see, are going to hit if you don't accept this fact. This is perfectly all right to be somebody's deputy if he exists, but how about dreaming one up? How about dreaming up a source to be a deputy of? Perfectly all right to be a deputy. I myself found out, greatly to my relief, many, many years before Dianetics and so on, that I was a very good subordinate. I found out excellent. I took a great deal of pride in this, because most of my life, up to that time, I had been solely and entirely in command. And I began to wonder if there was something wrong with me, if I was the kind of fellow who only had to be in command. Was I the kind of fellow that couldn't be anyplace else but in charge, you see? Because I had these chaps around, you know. Fellows who couldn't be anything else. And one day I was appointed to a very subordinate post, and I had several officers in echelon immediately above me. I wasn't even really in charge of a section, don't you see? I was just a subordinate with a capital S. And after quite a while on that post and so forth, I suddenly looked at it and wondered why I was so pleased with myself. I was just grinning at myself. I look at myself in the mirror and find myself grinning, you know. And it was just because I was perfectly well qualified to be a subordinate, and everybody was happy with me as a subordinate, and they knew the things going on. a commanding officer in that particular instance would wave his hand in my direction and say, Hubbard, so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, and Hubbard would go do so-and-so and fix him up. Just like he said, you know, no embellishments. Took all the privileges of subordinate, you know, privileges of a subordinate is to goof. You know, to goof on occasion. If you don't have anything to do, I don't do anything, you know. I remember the CO of this particular instance used to leave at 10 o'clock in the morning. We were lying in dock, and there was no particular reason under the sun, moon, and stars to be around the ship, and I think I had about 60 ensigns. And he used to come in the morning. I'd be there about 8 o'clock and straighten everything out, and he used to come in about 9 o'clock, something like that, and then he'd hit the beach. Nautical term. He'd hit the beach, you see, with his cap and his raincoat on and so forth, and go home and read his pipe or something. And when he walked in, he'd give me a whole string of orders, rat-a-tat-tat-a-tat-tat-a-tat-tat. As a matter of fact, he was dead wrong. It was the lousiest sort of subordinateizing, see, whereby the top man is skipping his second-in-command because you are effective and efficient, and the second-in-command is not effective and efficient, and this is being made plain to the second-in-command by the top man. You know, I mean, one of these unbearable situations, you know. So the old man walked in, he gave me a whole string of orders, and I'd go around and give all the ensigns their hot water bottles to rush from here to there or whatever it was. Turn out the men and run them into divisions, have the inspection, that sort of thing. The old man hit the beach, I think, about 10 o'clock. And 10:15, I'd look around, see everybody was working, so forth. Put two or three of my chiefs alert on the situation, pat everybody on the back, get on my white cap, white top cap, my raincoat, pick up my briefcase, hit the beach. One day, everything's running like apple pie order. You see. The men knew if they got me in trouble, why, they'd be in trouble, so nobody got me in trouble and so forth. And probably there were dozens of them beneath me and these hundreds and hundreds of men and so forth that also probably hit the beach at 10:30, don't you? And one day at 10:15, I was clattering down the steps, ready to go ashore. I was in a big administration building. What we were doing was putting a ship in commission. And all of a sudden, why, the man's name, by the way, was Roger Edison Perry, Captain USN, old line. And Perry, you know, that is the Perry. And he was a descendant along these lines. And he was really all Navy, but actually a prince of a guy. And my God, he's forgotten something. And there I am, almost to the bottom of the steps, dressed for shore. And there he is, coming back to get his briefcase or something of the sort. So he says, well, Hubbard, he said, are you going over to the ship? I said, no, sir. He said, are you hitting, are you, you've got a conference over with the building instructors or something? I said, no, sir. He said, well, what are you doing? He says, dressed up and so forth. And I said, I'm going ashore, Captain. And he said, well, this is just a rare occasion. Christ, he didn't want to offend me. I was running his whole ship on. And so this is just a rare occasion. He said, you have some errand of your own. I said, no, sir, Captain, I do this every day. And he squirmed. And he said, well, he said, well, all right, he said, but you shouldn't make it so obvious. Very funny. Anyway, Anyway, the business of becoming a subordinate or being able to occupy a subordinate role was something that I was very happy to be able to do. But to occupy a top dog role, which is all the way up, you know, there's no government or God or something of the sort or any mystic vision back of you, and not even galactic empire status, don't you see? Couldn't even reassume one of your old identities on the whole track and saying, well, we once owned this, you know, we once owned this empire, and so forth, and just to be able to stand up in the howling winds of space, you know, that sort of thing, and confront everything simultaneously and stand there regardless of the dead cats, the alarm clocks, the bricks, and everything else which are coming your way, that took some doing. And that's all you look at when you look at this early history and so forth. It is simply a stable datum going into a very, very aberrated world. The truth of the matter is, although events of the world are moving ahead at a very giddy pace, and although there appear to be a lot of risky things going on in the world is really a better place because we are in it. Things have changed. We've changed the whole face of psychology, for instance. We've changed there are people around who know that we exist. Now, at no time, of course, could anybody have done this all by himself. It would take a... once in a while, early stabs and that sort of thing took a real beating. I'm well aware of one incident where they held off the 18 or 20 Philadelphia policemen and so forth who had come to arrest me as a witness in a bankruptcy. Nobody could ever get anything on me. I never did anything. But they can arrest and put in jail the witness in a bankruptcy suit, which is federal, don't you see? And the staff at that time in Philadelphia and so forth, when they first saw these cops starting to load up and load into the place and a couple of federal marshals and that sort of thing, simply held them off barehanded, insisted that they should show their cards and should do this and should do that. And these guys started to get cross with them. Next thing you know, it was a battle royal, man. And gave me an opportunity to catch my breath, and I don't know what would have happened. By the time the federal marshals came up to where I was, they were shaking so badly, and they were so upset and demoralized, you know, they'd had an awful time getting through that outer perimeter, that I took the gun out of one of them's hand and put it in his holster because I said, you're nervous. They were completely demoralized. They took me downtown, and I had to stand around for a while and get fingerprinted and so forth, and they didn't dare do anything because I hadn't done anything. And then they found out there'd been a dreadful mistake. You never saw federal judges and marshals and that sort of thing quite as embarrassed because they'd been told an awful lot of lies from the Wichita Foundation, which, of course, was a squirrel outfit which had continued on. Bad old days, the bad old days. I was out of there no time at all. I mean, I had... people this way and this way. In other words, people were standing up for me here, there, and every place, don't you see? And anybody trying to do anything to me was wading in through depth. But from where I looked, it looked awful lonesome occasionally. It takes some doing. It takes some doing. And we operated very well and have ever since in a sort of a ragged sort of way as a fairly compact group. And it's only been that has been possible to go ahead and make the progress we've made in society. Now, you may not think we're making too much progress in the society and so forth. We'll get back to what I was going to tell you in the first place, is we've never started. All we've been doing is standing still, waiting for the flat irons and dead cats to sort of clear out of the air. Because just putting in a stable datum of Dianetics, just putting in a stable datum of this particular character, blew off enough confusion in the society so that it would make it possible after a while for us to move. For a long time, it was impossible to hold a position very fixedly or straight. Very, very impossible. And therefore, where you see the early foundations moving this is just standard phenomena. They moved from here to there to the other place, don't you see? They used to have an axiom that it took about 2 years for the flat irons to catch up with us, you see? And after about 2 years, well, there wasn't anything more you could do in that locale. And sure enough, that was about the time lag. It was tough, but we were, in actual fact, as an organization, I was standing there as a being, but as an organization, and so forth, we couldn't stand up to everything that came our way, don't you see? Now, I may have given you the impression that we made no progress and so forth. My whole idea throughout this entire time was to go on and do my researches, finish it up, and deliver the goods, in spite of every interruption and so forth, to eventually come out the other end with a case progress for every case that came under anybody's nose, that it could be done easily and so forth. And I devoted my time exclusively to research. And I paid no attention at all to the brickbats and the dead cats. Let them fly, see. Well, maybe that was rough on people. But actually, the group has constantly, more or less, been asking me to stand up, like the general manager did so that he could save his board, don't you see? Back in 1950, the group has been asking me to stand up and actually direct an advance line into the society. And instead of that, I have been sitting back, fixing up the general situation of technology and so forth so that it could be delivered. I've somehow or other kept the organizations running and functioning, in spite of all these other things. But I've not concentrated on that at all. I've taken lots of time and lots of energy, in pushing around communication lines and writing things for organizations, working for and working in organizations, but the bulk of my time was spent on research. Now, you have to have something to hold up there. You have to have accomplishment, and you have to be able to deliver. Now, we could deliver to some limited degree. In the early days, the reason we didn't deliver, please get this very straight, and why I was telling you about early turbulences, the reason we didn't deliver is because there wasn't any way to enforce the way to do it. Do you understand? You could give somebody some directions, but he did them wrong, and that kept the whole of Scientology, Dianetics rather, that days, that kept the whole of them interpolated. Now, how did it keep them interpolated? That's because by unstraight technology, improperly administered, their cases did not make an advance. Do you follow? There'd be enough very bad auditing here, there, and so forth to upset people here, there, and so on. And there wasn't any way you could discipline the administration of the technology. Now, you have to have two things in order to discipline the administration of the technology. Three things, actually. First, you have to have the technology. You can't be pushing hidden standards off on somebody. He doesn't know what the technology is, and you're raising hell with him for not using it. You see, you can't do that. So you have to have the technology, and you have to be able to make that technology known. In other words, your instructional materials and that sort of thing, and the publication of the technology has to be very good. And the third step is you have to be able to police its use. In other words, make sure that it's that technology that's being applied. Now, there is the 1, 2, 3 of an organization, whether it is in administration, whether it is in technology, or in any other way. We put a stable datum into the world. It was, of course, completely impossible to have finished off all the technology and so forth by 1949, published it in an orderly fashion in 19... Well, you could do this maybe if you were... You were talking about a new design for kiddie cars. But not, for God's sakes, something that required the entire experience of a group and that required its entire contact and so forth with society. You couldn't just say, well, there it is in all orderly fashion, I'll go ahead and do it. I mean, that's the ideal, the unthinking ideal, but no, we live in a very real world. And I upset some of you when I talked to you about getting arrested and fighting and all this sort of thing. But the truth of the matter is we aren't just an idea. See? You have to differentiate between a nice philosophy lying in a book, disturbing nothing on a shelf, not even reading itself, and bringing individuals, live human beings, up to a point of recognition of their own beingness. Now that is a live action. That's totally live as an action. Now, we don't look at it because it's much easier to face a concept or an idea than it is to face a living, breathing entity. And from 1950 forward, we were a living, breathing entity. From about July, when I took over, to the degree of saying, all right, I'll stand up to it. All right, we will push it through. Up to that time, we could be a very nice excitement that people could leave alone or not leave alone or something like that, and we didn't have to be very serious about it. But a lot of people were being serious about it, don't you see? No matter how it was stated, a lot of people were being serious about it. And we then were a live, breathing thing. And we weren't just an idea. And if you get an idea, if you think that 1950 was just somebody who, well, he just wrote a book and people took exception to the ideas, or there was some trouble about the ideas, or this guy was not well braced to take over such a standard, horribly prominent point in the spotlight of existence, and that was all that happened. You have an entirely wrong concept of the situation. We were live, breathing things, me amongst you. And the point is, we were not at any time along the line anything else. We weren't a philosophy going through the society. We were beings. And when we first started up the line, it was the interbulation of the trillions which began to blow. It was pretty much just asking people to confront their banks. It was pretty much pretty tough. And nobody was in a really steady state while being better than the man on the street alongside of him. Nobody was in any very steady, stable state. And when people processed each other, there wasn't any way to really get the straight information for this. And therefore, they weren't able, as you were able today, to run out your overts and PTCs and feel a lot better. Bang, you see? Oh, no, they didn't have this technology. We had to fight our way up in a very aberrated state. We had more ways to knock out the whole track than we did to knock out or even know about our little overt in the last hour. Didn't even know about it. No, we didn't have weapons at that particular time. We had a lot of technology. We had more than man ever dreamed of, but that wasn't very damn much. And we had started at that time to make a hole, you might say, in the conglomerate and collective aberration of mankind. Remember, it was a livingness that was making that hole. We were live beings. It wasn't the principles making the hole, you see. It was we applying them and pulling ourselves up somehow or another off the rug or lower. Rough, having to stand in there, not really the good tools yet, don't you see? And not the communication and administration lines necessary to enforce those tools we had. The squirrel processes that were run, the guys that were half spun by them, and so forth, it's a fantastic back chapter. But remember, you're looking at a living being. Now, it's a good way to say, well, it's all Ron's fault that it didn't all go smoothly. That's right. You're perfectly, absolutely right. I should have been an OT who came to Earth and got a hold of somebody named Moses and said, hey, Moses, here's some rules. Now you go back off in front for me. Is anything wrong with that story? Can you imagine somebody doing that if he was capable of all that power? Hey, Moses.
Here's Ten Commandments, Moses. Don't let your people sell bad pig to each other. Only sell it to strangers.
No. This guy didn't happen. It just required more raw nerve to stand up by yourself. No, it'd have been best if I'd come in here from Arcturus, you see, as an OT, and simply said, man. That isn't the way it happened. That isn't the way it happened. It was up out of the ditch and by the bootstraps. And I should not go around saying, well, of course, I'm just very ordinary and very common and so forth. I'm probably very extraordinary, who knows?
I recall pieces of my own back track that certainly look extraordinary.
No reason to invalidate myself along the line. But the truth of it is, we were living beings and we moved up into the teeth of every aberration in the society, almost simultaneous at one fell swoop. And the confusion that blew off was so fantastic that as it's taken 15 years just to stabilize our position organizationally, where we could stand still and resist the brickbats which came our way. Now that is an evolutionary step which is vital to the growth of any organization, and we are through it. Very rough. We won. At any time we could have gone appetite over tin cup. We could have finished. We have been within an ace of it time and time and time again. Philadelphia, look at the frailty of it. Crazy fool wants to seize all of Dianetics. Can you imagine some dumb fool trying to seize all of Dianetics? Well, look it over. What was Dianetics? You say, well, Dianetics was a book or a copyright. Oh, no, Dianetics was a bunch of living beings. And he wanted to seize all this. Oh, he couldn't seize all that. It was not possible to hold. So he goes and tells the federal marshals and so forth that there is a bankruptcy suit in which this man is a vital witness. And he's about to leave the United States, so you had better arrest him so that he can testify in court. Crazy things, don't you say? The man's dead. He's very dead. Nobody could survive the overts which he pulled. That, not just that overt, but the many overts. He's very dead. I don't think that it was accidental, because his first love was money. And Susie was talking to Inland Revenue that we're trying to get her to pay some, or Internal Revenue was trying to get her to pay some wild taxes of some kind. Now, $125,000 worth of owed taxes on the old foundation. And she just looked him straight in the eye and says, well, we don't owe you this, as a matter of fact, and gave this man's name and said he was the fellow who made the money off of it, and if he's claiming this as taxes, you're never going to get it off him. He's clever. She just put the finger right straight on him. He's a very sweet girl. And Internal Revenue said the $125,000 he was claiming off his taxes for his expenses in trying to wreck Dianetics. They declared that his activity in Dianetics was a hobby. All of the money he lost trying to run this squirrel foundation, that Dianetics was a hobby with him. and therefore he had to pay all the taxes. He paid. He had to. The tide of that sort of thing, you see. One day he's perfectly able to present suits and so forth and get you arrested. The next thing you know, all you have to do is tell the government, well, it actually, that's the man that owes you the money, and they go over and collect it off of him. Now, that's a symptom of the turning tide. That's the only reason I mentioned these two things. At one moment, it's just the breath of a whisper, see. Why, half the cops in Philadelphia are down and picking you up and fighting with the foundation and all, you see, all kinds of things like this. A few years roll by, and you say, that's the man. They go over. Say, we're going to arrest you unless you pay up. See, the tide turns. The tide turns. It's gradually turning, just to that degree. That's a more dramatic thing. The people that in 1950 were having such a ball and wiping their feet on us and that sort of thing, well, actually, you could sort of cry to see some of those people today. It's not that it was us particularly. It was just they look in the same shape as somebody who had tackled a 10,000-volt power line. But it was a collective power line that they... See, it wasn't just one power line. They look pretty bad. One of them's living as a beachcomber. I hear rumors of this character now and then, so forth. I haven't got the slightest bit of rancor as far as these people are concerned. As a matter of fact, I feel a little bit bad about it occasionally and so forth. But they just made a head-on collision. Going to stop us in our tracks, don't you see? Ha, ha, ha. They got holes in the back of their heads. Now they're laughing on it, don't you see? The society at large, in other words, has first the people who attacked us, any people connected with those early days, those people are gone. They're either dead or they're in terrible condition, as the institutions which attacked us are weaker. You see, this tide has turned. We can now hold our position. We have for some time now been holding our location in space organizationally. We are able now to instruct in the right way to do something, and it gets applied. And we do that, it gets a result. We're able to hold our own comm lines. We're able to bring it up to a point where today I can calmly release a bulletin and say there's a new set of comm lines, and they are so and so and so and so, and I know they will go in. And we're sufficiently this way and that, but we can say, in no uncertain terms, our organizational form takes this shape. And it's mostly what shape do we want it to take rather than what shape have we got to take. We're dictating our form. Now, this is a big change. This is a big change. So in 1950, I said, it will go as far as it works, and it won't go any further than it works. And we're going to hold the fort here, and we're just, this is a holding operation. And I well knew that, instinctively, that the brickbats were going to come over hot, thick, fast, and furious, you see. The stable datum going into an aberrated society, and the confusion was going to blow up. I just did my work from that point on, working it out with the experience with people and things, holding the fort, getting gradually the lines in, getting gradually a greater security, getting gradually a little more forward motion, and all the time working on research. It will go as far as it works, and actually it won't go another inch further. So when people have said to me, why don't you get in there and administer it? And people have said to me, why don't you bang and hammer and pound away at dispatches? And why don't you do this sort of thing? No, for 15 years I have known it would go as far as it worked. It would go another inch further than that. That's all. And an organization will be as rich as they make it work. And things will be as smooth as it is working. And the individual will be as good as it has worked on him. And he will be surrounded by those who are as good as he has been able to make it work on them. And that's all. You've said it all. Well, it goes as far as it works. So at this particular time, I'm in the rather interesting and fantastic position of being able to calmly put in the organizational structure and to work hammer and tongs, which I am working right now, something on the order of maybe as much as 18 hours a day on putting in the administrative form and setup, which doesn't alter what we have got in actual fact, but simply makes it firm, takes all the lessons we have learned over the last 15 years, puts them in effect, smooths it all out, found the final form of the organization that'll work like a bang. It'll probably be that way 5,000 years from now. And there it is. Be able to put those lines in and write those things up with enough security, backed up thoroughly enough, backed up with enough enthusiasm, and so forth, so that those lines will go in and that's the way it'll be, and so forth. All the lessons, all the things we've learned can take effect. Because actually we got to a position where we were holding ourselves from expanding. It would go as far as it worked, had gotten up to a point where it was working faster than it was administered to handle. We have suddenly done a breakthrough here. This is a very peculiar breakthrough, very odd. But we're making clears. And these are shocked people because they've been expecting them for 15 years, never realized, of course, the best reason why you wouldn't make it clear was if the data wasn't straight. If your organizational form and the discipline of it all and the brickbats, if that wasn't good enough, and the brickbats coming your way were so terrific, and the yipple-yap in the society against the individual staff member was so great, you couldn't expect him to sit there and do any kind of a job. Even though he had the information in his hand, he would be so distracted he would hardly be able to duplicate the bulletin, don't you see? Well, you wouldn't have expected that to happen. Well, something funny has happened. It's class 4, and level 4 is supposed to be the clear level. And clears are emerging at 1 and 2. Very funny. And I won't mention any names. One of your instructors has just got through writing me an alarm note on the subject of a clear. And I'm going to put it in the auditor. Crisis on St. Hill course. What do we do with this person, see? We can't process this person on the rest of the processes between where she is and level 4 into 6. In fact, I don't think the person will now run on R6EW. I've got to break out the actual bank pattern and so forth and start posting it in the cabinets in there so she can run from the top down. I don't think she could find a dramatization on her bed. Clear, see? Clearing too early. We've got more problems, you see. Well, life is pretty difficult. It's pretty difficult to make a living these days because, you see, they clear too fast. Well, that's a different look than we have an awful trouble with this person, Ron. Drag him into my office in Elizabeth, throw him down on the couch, and find the engram necessary to resolve the case by some means or another, not even an e-meter. Turn him back over to the staff auditor and have him go run the engram and finish it up. And it looks a little bit different. And the guy gradually, dozens and dozens or even hundreds of engrams later, you see making a progress up toward clear. In the meantime, the society is caving him in. The suppressive persons on the other side of him are telling him he didn't make any gains, don't you see? All these various wild things occurring. A living in turbulence, not an in turbulence of data. Now we move over into the other line is, Ron, what do I do now? Hey, this person is supposed to go up through grade 2 and grade 3 and grade 4, and she can't possibly get her auditing check sheet because she's clear and won't run on anything. How do we fit this in? Crisis at St. Hill. Well, what is that? That is actually a more cleared environment. We aren't getting lambasted every day in the press, don't you see? We're not getting this, we're not getting that. Your environment is getting clear, so a person possibly could breathe and get audited without a whole bunch of PTPs in the next 5 seconds. You see, it looks better. It looks better. And it's very symptomatic. I come in today, and I lectured to you the last time I lectured to you. Before that, you were all black in the face. And last time you were, I come in today, and you look a great deal brighter, and you look a great deal brighter than that. Well, that's because a channel of order has been introduced into this particular course, which, of course, has its rough edges, as they always do, but is smoothing out, and I think by this time it's smoothed out. In other words, we're in a position in this course now where an instructor can take responsibility for a certain strata of the students of the course, the individual responsibility for those students. In other words, he can stand up now in the end theta of the environment and that sort of thing and wear his hat. Things are becoming more orderly, don't you see? Up to that time, he had to sort of stand on the fringe of all of this commotion. Well, let's put him in there and let him take it on the chin. It'll smooth out. And I noticed just looking at you today that you smoothed out remarkably. Well, the action of administration is simply smoothing out the turbulence of the environment, and that's all there is to it. When you introduce a stable datum into the environment, it blows all over the place. It blows up, practically. You very often introduce somebody to Scientology, and you see a tremendous amount of confusion ensue. He's going through the same thing. He collides with the people in his immediate environment. They haven't gone any place. He has. So he is, to some degree, getting his block knocked off in his environment, don't you see? He's going through, as an individual, the same horrible curve that any of the rest that we went through as a group. And this individual very well could possibly get himself into a lot of trouble and that sort of thing. But I point something out to you. If he keeps at it, why, it won't take him 15 years, as it would a larger group, to get up to a point of where he can hold his position in his case game. Don't you think? In the first place, he's served by far better technology. He's served on communication lines that can be administered. There's a terrific relationship, you see, between the environment and the individual and the speed with which a process works. And you've got to be able to get a process working on somebody that will be sufficiently effective. This is what these people go out here and say, well, I'm going to audit R6 on the public, you know. They miss the whole point. All they're going to do is unstabilize the guy. They don't dare unstabilize a man in his environment this much. The environment's going to knock his block off if they unstabilize him to that degree. This guy's got to learn to walk his in his environment. You don't tell him to fly and then knock him down and laugh. That's a horrible thing. No, this guy's got to go out there and he's got to have something that he can understand and grasp and communicate to his environment and so forth, because he's going to get plenty of randomity anyhow. And this result has to happen fast enough to take care of these things, you see, before the environment knocks his block off. It's a race between the auditor and the environment, this man's environment, see? And it's always that kind of a race. And that's true of us as a group, don't you see? It was a race between us and our environment. We were living beings. You've processed a living being, and his relationship is between himself and his environment. You, therefore, have to be able to deliver technology to him that he can somehow or other stand up with. And you don't dare unsettle him and throw him back into his environment. Well, you've got to bring him up on a line where he can hold those gains stably and that there are real gains to him and so forth, and he can go back into the environment. Furthermore, you've got to provide him with a certain amount of administrative protection. And today, you've just been given weapons of administrative protection for your PC. And you've been given a method of forcing a PC to take action and not keep on messing up in his environment and knocking himself downhill. This is all germane to the situation. No, we are more powerful. We are more powerful than we have ever been before. And things are more stable. And processes can go in, and administrative systems can be evolved and presented. Hats can be checked out on them. We can have a rather simple administrative system. We don't have to have a very complex one, as long as the thing is well followed, as long as its channels are delineated, as long as our mutual understanding of the existing situation and the lessons which we have learned up all these years and so forth continue to be applied, we're perfectly fine. We're in a position of much greater ability in the society. Scientology is up the world around. It's going up, up, up. It doesn't look like it sometimes in an organization that's fighting for its life and so forth. Until you look at the curve and look where the state of the organization was a few years ago, or even last year. Why, you don't get the kind of a picture it is. Now, you've got to bring up an organization on a gradient the same way. Some of you will be putting organizations in, or handling the putting of organizations into place in the society, because there will be hundreds of organizations tomorrow, where there's only one today. The ratio is going to go up at a great rate of speed. I'm pulling the blocks. I'm pulling every point and barrier and so forth off the line that keeps us from expanding right now. They at one time were protective barriers. We mustn't do too much of a forward fly up the line, because we would have gone too fast and we would have wrecked ourselves beyond that. So we had lines that were blocked, lines that were blocked, lines that were blocked. My whole job right now is entirely devoted to administrative actions. I'm just putting the administration into effect, putting it into effect. My whole action is spot the place where the jam was, spot the place which restricted expansion, and pull the pins on it, and then spot another place which restricted expansion, and look back and pick up the policies that handle that sort of thing, you see. Put in the communication lines, pull the block out. And you can't go at this very long as an auditing process on an organization which is already restricted in its ability to expand without some fantastic things occurring. Now, the trick is to do this without unsettling the existing organization. So you begin to see in these bulletins now, do not disturb any line which is actually in and operating at this particular time. Leave all those lines in, regardless of what they do to your org board and so forth. The lines which are working for you will still work, don't you see? Also put in this other set of lines which parallels that set of lines, don't you see? Well, now, what I'm working for is an accelerating curve. And this will occur, and you'll see it in a relatively short time. We've gotten to the point where the society itself can be bowled over. So we might as well just start knocking the aberration out at a very high rate of speed. We're past the critical point of case gain. Now it really doesn't matter how fast the case gains. We have made our point of stability. We are there. We've got our feet down. We can hold our position. We don't have to back up because somebody whispers in our direction. We can hold our communication lines in. We have just gone through two governments trying to knock our blocks off, and we have emerged at the other end thumbing our nose at them in a very impudent fashion. The United States government is so scared to bring that thing to trial, it's pathetic. I had the British government ask them the other day about it. Right. They don't know anything about it. I imagine after a while they'll get mad and bring some wild suit and try to finish this thing up or try to do something and so forth. But it's sort of like a boxer who has gone down on one knee 15 or 20 times already in this fight, don't you see? And he isn't very enthusiastic about lifting his head. So if he does anything at all, he sort of punches at the referee. See, he hasn't got any direction left because the attacks which we're getting are directionless. Doesn't look like that maybe to the poor guy down in Melbourne. Well, I should imagine Melbourne feels pretty cocky. It's lived through it. I notice Melbourne's coming up. For a while, they were nattering at St. Hill and nattering at people. And so on as you could imagine, they had their heads knocked off down there. Well, they must have been very strong or they wouldn't have stood up to that. It actually doesn't matter much what the press does say about us now. You could have screaming headlines come out in every newspaper in the world. Scientology is no good. And everybody'd say, ho hum. They have worn that out. We have heard that all before, don't you see? We've lived through these things. Now, what we've got to face up to now is the fact that our expansion will be an accelerating expansion. What we've got to do now during this year is finish up getting our communication lines in and square things up. There's some really marvelous things in the works, fortunately. The whole basic administration, technology and so forth is laying out before the eye. These things are quite wonderful, some of them. Fascinated with them. They just most fabulous operating keyboard you ever wanted to play on as an organization in this particular universe. It isn't play on it either. If you want to strengthen up an organization, stabilize an organization, and that sort of thing, just find the expansional blocks and pull them. And find the things that, you know, that block expansion. Find those expansion blocking barriers. See, I find those things, pull it. Find those things, pull it. Open up your communication lines, put in your barriers and so forth on the edges of the communication line, not in the middle of it, so that you channel your action and so forth. Just keep doing this, strengthening up the edges, letting the lines flow harder. Strengthening up the edges, letting the lines flow harder. Going at the formula of how to put life into a group from the... In other words, we're very much causative in this. How do we put life into our organizations? How do we get them rolling again? How do we get them to stand up straighter and that sort of thing? Well, this year, they will go through several flickers and flackles, and they'll go up and down and so forth, and they will restabilize. But I can assure you that they will go very stably. It won't cost us any organizations to reorganize these things. Already put it to test. I changed the whole org board suddenly to a more workable org board last summer. I just told them all to put it in and put it on the org board, but not do anything with it or move anybody's chairs or anything. But just put that up. It was immediately followed uniformly over the world by an increase in income, a decrease in upset. So reorganization can actually mean a smoother run for everybody. All right, now we're just about to put in the rest of that org board. And we're about to put it in with a smash and a bash and a bang. Rather quickly, but with the same orders. Don't change any of the lines you've got, even though the line is wrong that you're actually using and so forth. Why put the person's name on the organization board the way the line is working, and also put this org board in too. And then gradually they'll see where these lines actually snap, and a lot of duplicate functions. There are a lot of duplicate functions right now in an organization being carried on in two different places. And these duplicate functions, one after the other, are just being deleted so that you've got single functions for each one of them. See? In other words, you're actually reducing the amount of traffic in an organization. The traffic in an organization is being reduced now, even though the potentiality is, well, I guess we've raised the traffic potentiality of an organization 200 or 300 times. I had just in the last day or two. The stuff will really be flying on those communication lines, but there's no barriers for it to hit, don't you see? There's people to catch it, you see, and there's things that people can do about it. The lines are wrong. Now the only thing we're asking a staff member to do organizationally and so forth is just discipline the communication line. And that's the only way we can get in trouble, is the fellow who fails to discipline the communication line. He doesn't wear his hat with regarding the discipline of how the communication is supposed to be done and how the thing is supposed to be rooted. Or he enforces the discipline so savagely and so forth that the ARC breaks somebody on the other end of the line. See? He's got to measure delicately between these two things. That's all we've got to do, because the technology and so forth has got to have lines to flow on. There is no vast rush at this particular moment, oddly enough, of getting the final technology out. There's no vast rush about getting a public book out. There's no vast rush about this sort of thing, because if we don't get the organizational line in, we're doing promotion, things are going up, it's all right, don't you see? But unless we've got those lines in, the same thing will happen to us. We'll interbulate, we'll have another peak where we're hitting the society with a great deal of new material, don't you see? And we're hitting the society with this material, and the society's reacting back against us. Well, we don't want the society reacting back against us without our lines in good shape. It would be folly, don't you see? So the thing to do is to set the lines up, get them very smooth, fix it up so that these things are all in form, and in a moment of stress, and with an expansional action and increased traffic, that there are lines for that traffic to flow on. Then follow it right up behind that with the actual release out into the public of additional technology, the release of it into the organizations. Frankly, everybody in these organizations is pretty well trained on the exact technology. It's a tremendous joke, don't you see? The newest and latest now. The newest and latest is about to be released into the organizations. The newest and latest is about to be released into the public. It's quite interesting. The newest and the latest is a subject called Beginning Scientology. That's the newest and the latest. I am being laggardly in giving you your level processes and your auditing check sheets for these levels, because they're just a little bit different than you think they are. They're a little simpler than you think they are. The processes are a little bit simpler to do, and I've got that material. It's all actually sitting on my desk. I hadn't had time to write up just the bulletin that delivers it to you rat-a-tat-tat, because you recognize all the processes now to do them. You say, how could it be that easy? I'm sure it'll be your first reaction to it. Not how do we learn all this terribly complicated? And then you all of a sudden cognite that, yes, these are the processes that always have worked, don't you think? But your first, the first book of Beginning Scientology is, of course, what book? It's a book called Beginning Scientology. And it composites the identical track of Scientology. And it has the elements, the successful elements, with none of the distractions, and the lead on in of everything we have done. That's all. You haven't got to worry about the rest of it. But we can cover years of that area in practically the breadth of an eye of the workable technology which existed there. The philosophy and so forth that went along with it. And the other developmental things, it's very interesting that the Philadelphia Lectures of 1953, is it, or something like that, or 52? Oh, 52. Those confounded things contain most of the technology for level 7. They're practically a textbook on level 7. So there's a lot of that technology, but it's not come out even, don't you see? I mean, it hasn't been released in exact chronological sequence. There's been some of the earlier technology was more advanced, don't you see? Well, all we have to do is take up what was released, more or less, at that time, as it went forward, right on up to PT, which fits the levels, and then take the stuff that was came out of sequence and add it on top of that, and we've got the whole subject. There's nothing much to this. There have been some tremendous discoveries and so forth during the last 12 months. As you may or may not be aware, the clay table, there's things of this particular character that are sweepingly important. The point is, the first book that will be released into the public is already written. It's called Beginning Scientology, and it has a small section out at the beginning of a book called Excalibur I wrote in 1938, and then it has the pertinent sections of the original thesis, and then it has the pertinent early sections of Dianetics, Modern Science, and Mental Health. All written. It's just a paste-up job. And all the distracting material is taken out of it, and then it's told, the person is told throughout, this book does not include the instructional drills, practical drills, and so forth, and doesn't particularly include all of the processes. You'll have to get those from an auditor from your local academy, see? And this isn't all there is to it. It goes on for several levels after this, you say. It describes the conditions to be obtained, but it tells the person exactly what to expect in attaining them, see? We don't make it a 15-minute wonder, don't you see? You get the idea? We say, after you've gone through a few levels, man, you'll be clear. We keep putting down footnotes, of course, with this, the material is not all the material, and that we could keep leading the people up along the line. Your next book up along the line is similar materials and so forth. It isn't just cut up old books, though. It goes off. It goes further into a more composited line. But we have to have that first entrance, but because that was our first entrance into the society. And if we leave that as a gap, no student thereafter would ever be able to understand that he knew what the earlier beginnings were. And he would have an unknown on his backtrack, which would make him uncertain. So we must have that. We must have that there, fronting up the line. Well, it's the first entrance point of the society, so obviously it contains the elements which make it the first entrance point of the society. Dynamic principle of existence is survived. That's all. Therefore, dynamics. You know this stuff. And the processes that went along with it that were very successful had to do with very light PT processes, had to do with communication and so forth. Doesn't matter if some of the processes were developed far later that fitted that particular level, that were much more effective. We just get the guy so we can talk to the people around him. We teach him about locks, and we show him something about engrams. Very interesting, an old-time Dianeticist the other day recovered his sight because somebody timed on an E-meter 2 engrams. Guy recovered his sight because he just got the date of 2 engrams. Didn't improve it once and then began to prove very nicely. Just heard about it. Here's the upshot of this, is this old technology was workable. But how could technology, on lines that were scrambled and was upset, somebody would have to write somebody who knew somebody in the Elizabeth Foundation who had a rumor that the latest technique was, and even though a bulletin was released at that particular time, the chances of it being received, followed, or applicable were very remote. Well, bring it up to the point the guy's spotting spots in space and spotting spots in the room or something like this, and he isn't doing it right. And the DP walks in and says, if you keep doing that wrong, son, you're going to be talking to a committee of evidence. That's a little bit different, isn't it? A little different view. And you say, that's a rough one to live in. No, that's a smooth one to live in. The society is a smooth society in which you can have some law and order. We're moving ahead into this. We're moving into a position of extreme maximum thrust, you might say. And we'll be there very, very soon. I'm not just shooting the breeze, because the information that is pouring in here now and the data which is crisscrossing and so forth, this shows that everything I'm putting out is being perfectly well received and going into effect very rapidly. The bad old days are actually repeated by every human being who faces up to the society and tries to stand up as himself and tries to stand up as part of a Scientology organization for the first time. He's hit with a confusion, but fortunately, due to the work we've done and the research we've done, the period is over very soon if we do our job well. But everybody goes through that same cycle. You get a new person. Oh, it's fine, it's wonderful, it's delirious. It's great, it's great, it's great. You see him the next day, he's falling flat on his face. Somebody's invalidated the living pants off of him, don't you? Bing-bang, this way, up and down, and so forth. Recognize what you're looking at. The guy is he's putting new data, new stable data into his environment. The confusion's blowing off. There's new stable data gone into him, and the confusion is going off. It's a repeat track. It can't be otherwise, because the road is up and out, and man was way below a level of confusion. He was too far down to even know he was confused. Thank you very much.